Welcome to Darwin Denied, the essential bookshelf. This is a series of podcasts, video casts, whatever you call the video versions of these things, where we're going to be reviewing different essential books in understanding and refuting Darwinism. So Darwin Denied, the essential bookshelf. If you are interested in the creation evolution controversy at all and you want to be up on it, these are books that we think that you ought to know. My name is Douglas Wilson. I'm here with Dr. Gordon Wilson, and we're going to take a book. Every episode, we're going to take a book, and the format will be basically this. One of us will be introducing the book, and we will introduce the book by giving you what we think the essential takeaway point is from that book. What should you learn from that book? And then after we've briefly summarized that takeaway point, we'll discuss among ourselves, and you're welcome to join us. So today we're going to be talking about Darwin's Black Box, which is by Michael Behe. Darwin's Black Box. The essential takeaway point in this book revolves around a phrase, irreducible complexity. Irreducible complexity, to use Behe's illustration of a mousetrap. A mousetrap is a very simple mechanism, rudimentary Stone Age, compared to the mechanisms that are going on inside a single cell, or the mechanisms of the engineering mechanism of an ankle or a wrist, or what's going on inside the liver. My brother-in-law is a medical doctor, and he said he had an atheist professor in medical school who said he was an atheist because the liver is so complicated that God couldn't make one. A compelling argument.
Wow.
So we have very exquisitely designed mechanisms in every form of life, and compared to those, the mousetrap is just a very simple, rudimentary mechanism. Irreducible complexity essentially means this. In order for the mousetrap to do any good at all, to catch even one mouse, all the component parts have to be present and arranged in the right order and operational. You cannot, this is a mixed metaphor, but you can't evolve a little wooden platform and then that catches a few mice. And so 10,000 years later, it evolves a spring, and then it catches a few more mice. And then 100,000 years later, it evolves a lever, and then it really starts catching mice. When all you have is a little wooden platform, it catches no mice at all. There is no survival advantage. There's no natural selection survival advantage for any one of the pieces of an irreducibly complex mechanism. Mm-hmm. So that's basically what you're going to get from Behe's book, and he illustrates it with what it takes to, you know, the clotting of the blood. What is involved in blood clots?
The psyllium, the bacterial flagella, a number of icons.
Right. So things that people point to, and so you have to say this thing will not work at all. If I have a watch that just has the glass cover, it's not going to tell time a little bit. If I have a watch with the minute hand, it's not going to tell time a little bit. If I have one gear from inside, it's not going to. It does absolutely no good at all. Right. And if it has any impact on the process at all, if a creature is dragging the little wooden platform around that's catching no mice, that's going to be contributing a survival disadvantage. Mm-hmm. It's not serving any useful function. It's not doing anything. All the other pieces that are required to give survival advantage are missing. They're just gone. So that's the takeaway point. It's a wonderful book, an inspiring book. The more you study what's going on in the physical world around us, and particularly with life, things that are alive, the more awe-inspiring it is. So to kick off our discussion, I wanted to read a quote from Jerry Coyne, who an evolutionist who wrote a book, Why Evolution is True. And this is his very cursory interaction with the idea of irreducible complexity. Coyne says this, intelligent designers argue that such traits involving many parts that must cooperate for that trait to function at all defy Darwinian explanation. So far, so good. That's a good summary. Therefore, by default, they must have been designed by a supernatural agent. This is commonly called the God of the Gaps argument, and it is an argument from ignorance. So,
boy,
do you have anything to say about that?
I do have something to say. God of the Gaps is a real thing. When you think of a primitive culture and a volcano goes off, they don't understand any kind of geologic understanding of lava and earthquakes and fissures. And so when they see lava coming out of the ground, they may come up with this idea that, the God of the earth is angry because they don't understand. So that would be a legitimate example of God of the Gaps. I don't understand the mechanism of geological processes. So I'm just going to conclude that some mystical animistic force is angry. The reason why an irreducibly complex system is not a God of the Gaps is that it's not because we don't understand, it's because we do understand.
We understand what a complex mechanism is.
We understand what's going on. We've pulled apart, the molecular biologist or the cell biologist has ascertained all of the parts of the system. They understand how they interact, how they're integrated, and they do understand. They understand it so well that they realize that no naturalistic process can account for it. That's not God of the Gaps. That is exactly the opposite.
It's not an argument from ignorance, like Coyne says. It's an argument from knowledge.
Right.
Right.
And you can come up with, the naturalist has tried to answer Behe by saying that, it's not irreducible because there are other functions for some of these component pieces. Behe is not saying that there isn't necessarily a function for some of the components, other components. He is saying that that particular system cannot work until all of the pieces are put together in a certain way, in the right quantities. It's not just about the actual parts and making sure all of those parts are the right shape to interact with each other. You've got to assemble it properly. If you were in a mousetrap factory, all of the parts might be there, but that doesn't make those parts actually assemble themselves. So you've got information. There needs to be some kind of rudimentary blueprint to cut the wood to a certain dimensions and all of the springs and there's a lot of information in all of the component parts, but there's another level of information, which is the assembly instructions on how those parts are put together.
And in what order.
Again, it's not a God of the Gaps. It's really understanding, what is going on.
So when Coyne he's doing a species of hand waving here, God of the Gaps if he just says God of the Gaps argument from ignorance, he's just blithely walking by a devastating argument that's mounted against his position. So when you have let's go back to the example of the mousetrap. So if you evolve a little wooden platform and then a spring and then a lever, you have to remember, let me hit the pause button there for a minute. In naturalist nature shows, evolutionary nature shows. They keep falling into the language of design.
Yes, they
can't. Dawkins acknowledges that everything looks designed.
Right.
And they have to argue that that's an optical illusion. And they keep saying nature
it's
did
apparent
this.
Design, not real design.
Nature did this and nature did that and nature did the other thing, which is quasi-religious language.
It's evolution of the gaps.
Evolution of the gaps, exactly. But when we're if we were evolving a mousetrap, the genes that are coding for the genes that are coding
for each component,
and you get the wooden platform because of a mutation.
Mm-hmm.
Or there's a mutation that here's a little wooden platform. The code that is causing the platform to come into existence is unaware of the existence of wood, the existence of mice, the existence of mechanisms.
Yeah, it's all accident.
It's pure, sheer, random accident.
Right.
So the genes that code for eyesight. So what do you call a partially evolved eyeball? Well, blind.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Well, we have to be careful on some things. I think that if something's not an irreducible complexity, doesn't necessarily take away, it's not conceding points to an evolutionist. There's a number
I'm sorry, what's not conceding points?
Yeah, when you say that something is not irreducible, there's a lot of things, like, for example, somebody who may have an eye without a lens could see... As the gospel says, men walking around that look like trees, a cloudy cornea or a cloudy lens can still confer an advantage to the person because a little bit of sight is better than no sight. The reason why the intelligent design argument or the irreducible complexity argument needs to go down to the molecular level is because when you're talking about an exceedingly complex organ with many, many millions of cells, it's very hard to inventory all of the parts. And to blithely just say it's irreducible is to be sloppy. So you really have to do rigorous science to say, okay, in order to know that it's irreducible, I have to have a clear-cut inventory of all of the parts in a particular system. And sometimes when it's a big organ with lots of tissues, it's just impossible to inventory. It's definitely designed, but to use that irreducible complex system, you've got to have a finite number, and you have to experimentally remove part A, see if it works, and then experimentally remove part B, see if it works. It's pretty rigorous science. It's very rigorous, but we just don't want to sloppily say this is irreducible or this is irreducible.
If I could jump in there, with the evolution of the eye is maybe a good example to push on this, because the evolutionist postulates that it began with skin that was
photosensitive, yes,
sensitive to light. So there was a mutation that caused skin to be reactive to light, more reactive to light than other parts of the skin.
Right,
and it just so happened that the two spots are on both sides of my nose, so it didn't look ugly.
Right.
It was in the middle of the forehead.
Right.
The females would have nothing to do with you. The problem with that, I think, is, and they would say, when I say, what do you call a partially evolved eyeball? Well, blind. Well, sometimes you've got a partially evolved eyeball that's not blind, but other times it's totally blind.
Depending on
which which part is missing and what function it's doing.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing is, if I tried to get from photosensitive skin to an eagle's eye, to a fish's eye, or to a human eye, it's kind of like trying to imagine the evolution of an iPhone out of a transistor radio, mm-hmm. or, yeah. you know, or a locomotive out of a bicycle.
You right.
know, the so, bicycle moves you, so right. does the locomotive.
My point was not that it's not irreducible. What I'm saying is that if you sort of ratchet it up to where each part is like a lens or a cornea or a retina, you start to get on the skinny branches in terms of saying each of those tissues are components of an irreducible complex system. Michael Behe makes it very clear that there are irreducibly complex systems in the vision cycle, but we're down to inside the cell looking at all the component parts of photoreception, how what is the biochemistry? And then you can start to really inventory all of the molecules that are necessary for a nerve impulse to fire down the optic nerve. That you can actually look at and tally up all of these parts and show that it is irreducible complexity. So when you're dealing with an organ system, which is many, many or organ, there's just hundreds of thousands to millions of cells. And each cell, this is the interesting part, each cell is not just an irreducible complexity. A cell has many, many irreducible complexities inside the cell. So it's really, really good to zoom down, but often it will go over people's heads. That's why I think this book is so good, because Behe is a man after my own heart in that he uses a lot of analogies, like a teacher ought to take someone who's not familiar with the molecular world and use these tangible analogies to build these complex systems, so we can a layperson can wrap their mind around it.
And so when you talk about the many irreducibly complex systems inside a cell,
right.
how cells come together to create different mechanisms that are themselves irreducibly mm-hmm. complex, like the blood clotting system, or eyesight, or the ear, or you know whatever. It's like trying to imagine yourself winning Powerball every 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
the probabilities
are. What are the odds? And so you can imagine a world in which a little wooden platform conferred some survival advantage.
Right.
And maybe in another critter, the spring by itself conferred mm-hmm. some survival advantage. And you could imagine how photosensitive skin would do that, or an eyeball that saw things fuzzily.
Right.
Like, we don't see things as sharply as an eagle does.
Right.
And we have, you know, yeah. our eyes give us survival advantage,
yeah.
not as much as mm-hmm. if we could see like an eagle. But the optic, the genes that are coding for these things, they don't know that the optic nerve is supposed to connect yeah. to the brain. They don't know not to grow the optic nerve out of the side of your head.
And how do you get this burst of impulses that are coursing down an optic nerve, arrive at the occipital lobe of the brain, and actually this pattern of impulses that hits this part of the brain actually produces an image in the brain, which is perceived. And it's when you look at the complexity of biology, even at the most elementary level or at the undergraduate level biology, it's over the top complex. And yet the evolutionists will keep on studying it, very firmly entrenched in their notion that some flavor of Darwinism is true, that naturalism is true. They keep unveiling more and more. It doesn't get simpler and simpler. It always gets more and more complex, beyond what I ever need to teach to my sophomores. It gets more and more and more complex, and yet they blithely continue to say it just happen.
Not only that, but the and I don't want to stop me if I'm going to get into one of the books we're going to treat later.
Sure.
But not only so, but a lot of this complexity is spiritual, not non-tangible, non-physical, like information.
Yeah, it's can't weigh information.
What color is it? Information. So if my optic nerve sends signals to my brain,
your brain doesn't get heavier.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Good example.
An empty thumb drive doesn't weigh less than one that's has many, many files loaded onto it. Information is a very interesting phenomenon that is just sort of not very tangible.
And a lot of the complexity is there in the arrangement.
In the arrangement of the matter.
Information.
It's the same with paper and ink. You can have paper and ink, same amount of paper and ink on paper, and it can be meaningless splatter or gibberish, or it can be informational. And this is where we need to realize that DNA can be sequenced in a way that is gibberish, and it's not, it's still DNA, but it's not information.
Right.
And then if you order the DNA in a particular way, it codes for a particular sequence.
So when you see the mouse, returning to Behe's example, when you see the mousetrap in operation, mm-hmm. you see how it's designed to function, et cetera. But when you see the blueprints, or if someone's describing to you their invention, they just invented the mousetrap, and they're describing how it would, and first you do this and this and this and this, you can see the irreducible complexity of the idea, the invention, the patentable thing,
mm-hmm.
right? The person could take the idea and patent it, and that's irreducibly complex also, and it doesn't weigh anything. It doesn't have mm-hmm. any color. It's not in the world yet.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
All right. So thanks for joining us. We would like you to encourage you to read Behe's book, Darwin's Black Box. We're going to return week after week discussing different books that pertain to the whole question of creation and evolution. Most of them are going to be written by critics of evolution, and usually Christian critics, but not always. Sometimes secular critics of evolution, and sometimes we'll touch on a book that is not written intending to be aimed at evolution, but it has that effect anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So, thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
My name is Courtney Skeen.
My name is Tim Clemens.
Curtis Spencer.
Emily Davis.
I'm Josh Clemens.
My name is Gwen Burrow, and I graduated in 2010. I've been working as a writer, editor, and event planner.
And I'm currently working as an account manager.
Engineering company and cybersecurity.
Computer programmer and data engineer.
It's a financial planning company.
I work for a small tech company here in Moscow, Idaho.
That's actually one of the best things I've ever taken away from NSA is how to learn. How to study. I had never had to push myself that hard, ever. And I clearly needed it, especially at age 23. I was capable of more than the college I had been going to and what it demanded of me. So I needed the push in the languages, the push in deadlines, and then the challenge of the grading system itself. It was all amazing.
Being able to be interested in anything and everything and being willing and able to go out and research it all the way down to the ground.
Having all of those skills and the understanding of people and understanding of how to communicate opens up a lot of job opportunities.
You think of yourself now and then in 4 years' time, what do you want yourself to look like? And is the education that you're considering going to help you get to that place?
When you're a student, you want to become like your teacher. You're going to become like your teacher. And so you want to be studying under people who you know you want to become. And looking at NSA beforehand, I knew I wanted to become like the men who are teaching here.
Fireman, husband, father, doctor, no matter where you want to go, NSA is just such good preparation for the person that you want to be.
If you want to be an effective Christian, you need to be able to lead and shape culture. If you want to do that, no matter what your occupation is, you need to shape yourself, prepare yourself as a person for that job. And liberal arts is, I think, the best education you can have for that.